Moving toward the light, Max came to an island of burning candles in a lake of melted wax, separating him and the rest of the congregation from a barefoot man in an Oxford shirt tucked into a striped Mayan kilt. While the man gestured and shouted, a still figure sat beside him in a rocking chair. For an instant, Max thought that chair held a corpse, but then he recognized the thing as a doll, a department store mannequin hidden under the brim of a Houston Astros baseball cap and behind mirrored aviator sunglasses. A scarf covered the mouth, and the idol otherwise wore a wide-lapelled sports coat from the 70s, a dress shirt with a thick tie, and slacks tucked into knee-high, furry boots designed for ski vacations. Members of the congregation set money, candles, cans of beer, cigarettes, and bottles of spirits on the floor in front of the idol. The shaman attending the mannequin upended a large bottle of the local rot gut called Quetzalteca, pouring the clear stuff into a small glass, showy as an uptown bartender. He spoke in a husky smoker's voice, then rocked the figure back in its chair, slipped the bandana from the face, and fed it the alcohol.
Kelly, can you give us a synopsis of the novel? It's a very new book, and we want to entice those listeners to pick it up.
It's a story of a born-again Christian young man who gets a chance to go and do mission work in Guatemala, where his wayward father that had abandoned him when he was a child happens to be kind of whiling away his years drinking himself to death. And so the son finds it kind of almost a sign from God that he needs to make amends with his father. That's the sort of literary relationship aspect of it. And then the thriller part of it is that they get in over their heads with a bunch of vicious gangsters and criminals who kind of trap them into having to work a bunch of dangerous jobs. And so there's a bunch of shoot 'em up kind of elements interrupting the father-son reunion.
You know, it kind of sounds to me like this would make a good movie, don't you think?
Yeah, sure. I do think so. I kind of see it very visually, and that's how I wrote it. And so, yeah, it does kind of seem to proceed scene by scene in the way that movies do.
You are a visual writer. I think that you have traveled so much in your life, and you've had a very adventurous life. From the bits and pieces I've looked at your bio and read about your memoir, Cloudbreak, I would think that really adds to a writer's toolbox, that you have all that experience, all that color to bring to your work. How important do you think it is to live life big, maybe before you ever sit down to the written page?
I think there are different kinds of writers. Emily Dickinson is the most famous kind of writer who barely left her house and yet is one of the
True.
Great poets of all history in English, for sure. But I'm more of the Hemingway school of going out and experiencing life, and I suppose my imagination isn't quite enough by itself, and plus I want to live an interesting life. I teach young writers, and I tend to let them know that they don't have to live this way to live large and have experiences necessarily, but it definitely helps, and why not? We only get one chance at this life as far as we know, and you might as well take advantage of it. So that's always been the way I live, just as a person, but also as a writer.
Maybe not join the gang, but but traveling in general, I think. And you've spent time in Guatemala. It comes through as almost another character in your book, very colorful in how you have the place against the people.
Yeah, I love Guatemala. I went there after college just because I wasn't ready to jump into the career path, and no one was actually offering me career-like jobs either. So I saved up my tip money. I was waiting tables for a living, and just took off to Guatemala and hung out for several months, picking up odd jobs and stuff like that. And it stayed with me all these years, which is why I ended up writing a novel about it. And yeah, it's really it's a place that wakes you up. It can feel very dangerous and chaotic. It doesn't have probably the most functional government at any given time. And yet it's beautiful, and in some ways it works so much better than things work here up in the wealthy United States. And so I've always been fascinated there. And I went back, you know, close to the point recently, the last couple of years, to do some last-minute research to get inspired for the book. And it's still kind of the same as it was in the 90s when I first went, in many ways. And yeah, I highly recommend it, you know, for people who want to travel and who want to get off of the usual tourist locations.
Tell a little bit more about going down there for research. What did you do? What kind of things did you involve yourself in for that?
I found a very inexpensive ticket to Guatemala, and there was a little bit of research money, just grant money that was available to me. I'm talking like, you know, in the area of like $300 or $400 kind of thing. And I thought, you know, this is a great time to take advantage of this. And I had, you know, a couple of weeks maybe or 10 days, and I just kind of flew in there. Part of it was just remembering how to take the buses and how that whole thing works. And I spent the night in Antigua, which is a really beautiful, fancy, and even kind of an expensive city for Guatemala. They have million-dollar houses there because of the foreigners who go there. And then I jumped on one of the buses that are so important to the book and that fascinate me. We call them chicken buses, you know, but they're these old United States school buses that are decommissioned, and Guatemalans make this epic journey up north, and these are just entrepreneurs that go up and buy them at auction, take them all the way back down to Guatemala, and then rebuild them and paint them these amazing colors. And they keep them running for decades, and they go everywhere. A stranger can just pop down into anywhere in Guatemala, go to any corner, catch a bus probably within 15 minutes, and find their way anywhere in the country. It's an amazingly efficient, or maybe not efficient, it takes a while, but it's comprehensive, user-friendly, and very cheap. And so I hopped on this bus and had this great experience of being kind of packed in with all these indigenous people and local Guatemalans. I was the only non-local there. And they get so packed in these buses that this American kind of sense of personal space that we have, I kind of was thought I might have a bench to myself, and I was very wrong. Like, I got every stop, more people would come on, and pretty soon there was a full-grown man, kind of this whatever middle-aged small guy in a cowboy hat, just fully sitting on my lap for about 25 minutes, and I was just thinking, it was just hilarious, really. But I also was thinking how good that is for, I guess, ideas of bigotry or feeling scared of the other, the dangerous other. Like when somebody's sitting in your lap for a half an hour on a bus, it's hard to fear them and see them as a scary stranger.
That's true.
So we went there, and then we went to a place called Xela. Quetzaltenango is the Spanish word for it. And it's just, and spent a couple nights there and wandered around and just tried to see some of the spots in the country to remember how things work on a basic level, and how things look and feel and smell, and ate some food and talked to some folks.
How much of an idea of what you were going to write about did you have when you went? Or did you just go to Guatemala because you knew that was the setting you wanted, and then the idea for the book formed?
Well, the first time I went to Guatemala after college, I had no idea that I was going to write anything. And but then I started, over the years, I started just writing, you know, like little short stories or just these pieces that felt kind of like chapters of novels, but just sort of picking at it, like here and there, taking little stabs at writing about this place and coming up with characters and something of a really loose plot. And this is over the period of like 10 years or so. And then finally, I started shaping it into an actual novel and coming up with real storylines and coming up with all the structure that it takes to make a novel.
Yeah.
And in fact, I was learning how to write a novel as I was doing this, because it isn't the same as writing a short story, say. So basically, I had a draft when I went down that second time, and I had a story, and but I knew I was going to go through it several more times in revision to brighten it up and thicken it up and give it a sense of a visceral, you know, sensual detail.
This is your first novel, but not your first book. As I mentioned before, you had a memoir, Cloudbreak, and you wrote about, in that memoir, you wrote about a complicated relationship with your own father, who spent time in prison for selling drugs. There's some echoes of that in this novel. Did this help you kind of explore that relationship a little bit more, or was that something you did on purpose?
Yeah, a lot of people have made that connection, and it is sort of an obvious one. But I think it was more, and that's not a criticism of the question by any means. I didn't think that I wanted to explore the relationship with my father in this novel. I really did that in the memoir and kind of explored it to the point where I just didn't want to. I didn't need to pick at that scab anymore. But obviously just the idea of estranged fathers and sons is just an idea that's just there in me without me even consciously thinking about it. The character Norman Carruthers is not anything like my father. And my father, even though, like, superficially you can see that both of them have some crime in their background, but Norman is more of a just hardcore expatriate, alcoholic, you know, one of those drinking from morning till night and just sort of managing to get through life that way. And I've met people like that and very much kind of a disease. My father has drinks and does different things like that, or did over his life. But he's never been that kind of a chemically dependent alcoholic. And also Norman Carruthers was works. He kind of was forced to make money, so he drives his bus full time while being sloshed out of his head, which I think is a uniquely Guatemalan thing. The ideas of drinking and driving don't apply there the way they do up here. And so, I had a chance to kind of play around with that idea of fathers and sons, but without feeling personally invested in the way that I did with my memoir.
When you first started teaching, and you are now teaching at Augustana College since 2007, I believe, on teaching English, but when you first taught, I understand that you taught in a Mexican classroom, English as a second language, and I wondered if teaching English as a second language helped give you a deeper or a different perspective on language, on how to use it, how to write. Did any of that contribute to your writing skills?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I learned so much about the English language, about the grammar of it and how it works in ways that I didn't know before, because I just took it for granted. You know, you just acquire language as a child when you grow up with it, and it's just there imprinted on you. So there's tons of people who speak English very well, but absolutely have no sense of how it actually works in grammatically or as a written code. And so I was already a writer and an English major, and so I already cared about language, and I did know some stuff about it. But then when I had to teach it to new learners, I absolutely had to, you know, people would ask me questions, and I didn't have the answer, so I'd have to figure it out. And also, it was my first time standing in front of a classroom, and realizing that I do like that, kind of helping, coaching some people who are there for reasons. You know, a lot of the Mexican students I had were in the tourist industry, and, you know, like, somebody's a cab driver and he makes a lot of his money by picking up gringo visitors. And the more he can speak to them, the more his business is going to succeed. And so I really just had a lot of good relationships with these students over this several months that I did that job.
And teaching seems to be an important part of your life now, as well as you teach creative writing. What are some of the more important lessons that you teach your students about writing, and what do they teach you?
Those are two good questions. The first thing I think about in terms of teaching at a four-year undergraduate institution, a small liberal arts college, is that a fairly small percentage of all my students, even my majors, are going to go on and become professional novelists or something like that. And so I don't see myself as an author trainer. I see creative writing as a discipline that is essentially about learning how to use words and storytelling techniques in a wide variety of applications, but also learning how to offer criticism in the kind of creative writing workshop mode, and receive criticism with grace.
Mm.
And all of those, it all kind of adds up to me to, I think, a really good general education that's applicable to all the different areas of life, including, you know, a former student of mine is doing really well for Microsoft, moving up the ranks of the Microsoft Corporation really quickly, because he writes, he told me this, he got his, like, a huge promotion. They're like, you write just such good emails. And and he also is really good at talking to groups of people. And he's just real, he did performance poetry and stuff like that. So he's funny, and he's just very successful in all those skills that we teach in creative writing. As far as what my students teach me, I mean, I guess they teach me humility most more than anything, and probably patience. Some of my students are so brilliant, but others are, you know, struggle in various ways that I feel myself being impatient about, but it's my professional duty to help all students, not just the ones that are easy to teach. So teaching has been, I think, good for just me as a person. And, you know, I'm sure if I really pored over it, if I had time to think about this, there's individual ideas for stories and the way to work on stories that those ideas are constantly evolving in me. And a lot of them come from my students or in these great conversations we have about individual stories, their writing or published pieces.
Yeah.
So I feel like they're always kind of helping me out in all kinds of ways.
You recently participated in a alumni reading at Western Michigan University. How was that to come full circle to where you got your doctoral degree?
I sat in on the first, there are two parts to it, and I sat in as an audience member on one, and it was fun to hear from some of my former colleagues, and it's really great to see that, you know, people that I studied with or that studied shortly after I left are really doing well and publishing big books and teaching at universities. And I just feel really, I feel like I'm in good company, and I feel like humbled that, like, oh my gosh, my next book better be really good if I'm going to keep up with these superstars. And I'm really looking forward to us getting a handle on COVID a little more, as we all are. And I'd love to go back to Kalamazoo and just see it physically. And
book touring right now is very challenging.
Yes, it is.
Planning any kind of, I see some bookstores and some authors doing like virtual events, Zoom readings, that kind of a thing. Are you planning anything like that?
I mean, just the alumni reading is a virtual event. And that's the only one that's immediately. I've had some things canceled or rescheduled.
Mm.
I was supposed to be in a book festival in September, but it's been rescheduled for next year, September, and they invited me just to come back. And I'm like, okay, that's good. Yeah, a lot of things. I was supposed to do a study abroad program in January in Mexico, and I had to cancel that. I'm just not a big virtual person. I'm on social media a little bit, and I don't, it's not like I hate it or I make this principled stand against it. It just doesn't, just like my traveling past, I like to go places. I like to kind of, you know, I don't like airplanes and airports all that much, but it's exciting just because I know that I'm going to get somewhere new. And so I'm more in a holding pattern than just embracing the virtual world like some people, and good on them if those folks who are really good at making a virtual presence for themselves. I wish I were better at it, but it just doesn't feel natural, and I do my best. But
yeah, well, hopefully this won't go on for I don't know, years. Let's hope it ends sooner so that we can all get back on the road and back together and actually see each other face to face.
Yeah, I think that I don't know. I tend to be kind of more of an optimist than a pessimist, but I do a lot of reading and I look for the most sane sounding voices in any subject, and it really does seem like spring through summer will probably be a good period of time where we're kind of getting a leg up on it because of a vaccine, and so I really do have a lot of confidence that by this time next year it'll be mostly in the rearview mirror. But you know, if I'm wrong, you can blame me for for my foolish optimism.
Well, may it be so, Kelly. Well, thank you for sharing some of your thoughts and letting us know about your book. It's on the bookshelves here in Kalamazoo.
All right. That's exciting. I can't wait to get there and see it. I'll take a picture of it and put it on the internet.